Where's my foot cushion? My foot cushion. Where's it going? Okay. So we'll just carry on from where we left off before. So we first sing our little prayer first to start, just reminding ourselves of our motivation. Do you need earphones? Okay. Wait till she gets ready. All got your earphones? Or your English ears? I've only got Australian mouth, I'm sorry. Oh, that's difficult. I'll do my best, but don't rely on it. I'll try. Okay. You got the right number on her radio? What number? Tell them, everybody. What's the number? Domanto secto uno puno. Okay. Okay. Okay, we sing our little prayer, which states two things. Remember, it's the first two lines are stating our reliance on the Buddha, reminding us of, you know, of our refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And the second two lines are kind of expressing this altruistic motivation, bodhicitta. We're going to listen to these teachings, and that includes me, I tell you, so that we can take some tools from it, so we can develop our amazing potential, so we can be a benefit to others. Thinking like that. Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chernyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shog. Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chernyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shog. Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chernyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shok. Okay, so for people who haven't been here, we'll just give some framework, but I mean, you know, all the teachings also can stand on their own very comfortably, I'd say. But what we're doing is we've been presenting all this week, since Tuesday, whenever, this packaging, particular packaging of Buddhist teachings, that's kind of the Tibetan way of putting things. All the teachings of the Buddha, from A to Z, but presented in a nice, orderly way. Orderly, of course, in terms of the capacity of the disciple, the capacity of the student to listen to it, hear it, and internalize it, you know. So the very first, you know, one of the analogies, as you hear, I've been using a lot, and it's a marvelous way to frame all the teachings. We've got a bird needs two wings, Buddha says, you know, especially in the Mahayana. Wisdom wing, compassion wing. So as we've been discussing, all the teachings about, you know, how to practice good ethics, how to not harm others, which of course is Buddha's view about how not to harm yourself, because everything we think and do and say, which is this law of karma, this natural law. I mean, Buddha's not a creator. He didn't make it up. He's observed it. This natural law that runs the minds and lives of all sentient beings, such that everything we think and do and say programs us, if you like. Buddha would have liked that analogy. Sows seeds in our mind that will produce our future. We're kind of like the creators of ourselves. I remember the Dalai Lama saying one time, the law of karma is like self-creation, you know. We don't need a creator. We don't need to be made by someone else. We make ourselves, if you like. It's a very powerful concept, you know. So that, of course, brings automatically, if we start to internalize that properly, accountability. We become grown up. We stop being a victim. We stop having attachment. We stop having anger. We stop blaming other people as like this innocent victim, which is really how we're talking about ego. So the wisdom wing is all about putting yourself together, abiding by the laws of ethics for your sake, as well as others, of course, eventually. And then, of course, really doing the actual job of being a Buddhist, unpacking and unraveling and becoming familiar with the contents of our own mind. Because as we know, if we look at the end result of all this path, the word Buddha, the etymology is very tasty, this Sanskrit word. Bud implies the utter eradication from our being, from our mind, our consciousness, our very being, all neuroses, all ego, all fears, all attachment, all anger. Buddha has found from his own experience that this stuff is not at the core of our being. So this is pretty outrageous, you know, pretty radical if we compare it with modern psychology. But this is what Buddha's found. So that implies the job and the essence of the job, having controlled our body and speech, having controlled our behavior, which is the ethics, we can then get to the root of the problem, which is all the rubbish inside, you know. So we can develop our true nature. That's the work that we do on ourselves. And now that qualifies us to go off and become a bodhisattva and help others, you know. If you can't see past your own nose, if you're full of neuroses and up and down like a yo-yo, and your mind's miserable and you can't control your mind and you're all over the place and you're depressed and angry, you can't help a fly, you know. So it's so clear, the inner work, which initially can look very selfish, or what are you doing looking, meditating, you're putting yourself together. You get the benefit, you become a marvelous person, but now you're qualified to help others because now you can see others more clearly, not through the lenses of your own nonsense, you know. The two wings of the bird, it's very powerful. So this whole idea of Buddha nature is very interesting. I mean, we talked, I think yesterday, about emptiness. And this is implied by Buddha nature. It's very tasty, you know. And again, because some of this language is coming from Tibet or coming from Japan, going back to, you know, 1,200 years ago, 4th century before that. So naturally it's fairly arcane sometimes and we don't understand it. So because it's spiritual, we tend to mystify it. So it's really important to put these things down to earth, you know. So the Buddha's saying, this Mahayana view says essentially all beings, and the term in Tibetan is very tasty, we've mentioned it, Semchen, all mind possessors. And remember, okay, so in different traditions the word is used differently, but certainly the way we've been studying here, the Tibetan Buddhist monastic university system tracking itself back, you know, to India, the word mind and consciousness are used synonymously. So the Buddha's view is his own finding, his own that he achieved this result from his own hard work, is that this is the natural potential of all beings. So that's a very tasty concept, you know. Okay. I always like to use the example of an acorn. So we know very well we learn it, that an acorn is a seed that if you plant it in the ground and give it a few conditions and quite a bit of time, it will manifest as an oak tree. We get that, you know. So, you know, Buddha says all minds have Buddha nature. Well, if we were speaking like the Buddha, we would say, and this is really helps us understand it, all acorns possess oak tree nature. It's very tasty. So by definition, in other words, by definition, and what an acorn is in its bones, in its actual being, an acorn is a potential oak tree. So then all Buddha's saying is every being, every one of us possesses just naturally. It's what defines us. I mean, this is where it's interesting. We look at relative reality. We call ourselves monks and nuns and man and men and women and maybe transgender or lesbian or black or white or whatever we might call. We have these labels we use and we tend to have an identity and we tend to, you know, often we cling to that identity. I'm a carpenter. I'm a ballet dancer. I'm fat. I'm ugly. We take these, some truths in them perhaps, but we take them and we make them, they loom large and we say, that's who I am. Like we were talking today, you know. You see, oh, a prisoner, oh, he's on death row. That's true, but it doesn't define the person. And this is really Buddha's point, that finally what defines the very being of every being is their potential to rid their mind of the rubbish and grow the goodness to perfection. Bud implies getting rid of the rubbish. I forgot to say the second one, da. That implies developing to perfection all the goodness. Buddha says that's at the core of our being. This is very tasty, practical, down-to-earth language, you know. And it's inspiring because we don't hear this in neuroscience. I mean, I have nothing wrong with neuroscience, but we don't hear that in our culture. In fact, in our culture, as we know, we give equal status to anger, jealousy, neurosis, psychosis, depression, love, compassion. Hopefully we haven't got too much of the rubbish and a bit of the goodness, speaking in simple terms. But the Buddha's more radical. Our true nature, he says, is clear, radiant, blissful, perfect. This is very cosmic sounding, but it's practical. There's a way of putting it in very practical psychological terms, not making it religious and superstitious, you know. So like we've been discussing from Lama Yeshe's book, Mahamudra, you know, looking at this classic way of presenting the two modes of meditation in Buddhism in terms of, in particular, this marvelous method, which is a bit similar to what they call Dzogchen, another tradition in Tibet. It's a way of using the classic first technique in Buddhism invented by these genius Indians more than 3,000 years ago called shamatha, shine in Tibetan, single-pointed concentration, this brilliant psychological skill. As I said, these Indians invented it. You know, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, it was these Indians more than 3,000 years ago who were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. I mean, we Europeans probably thought it was Mr. Freud 100 years ago. How arrogant we are. 3,000 years ago. And then Buddha came along, went as far as he could go in that tradition, and then he diverged in his own direction, in particular in relation to his own findings about the nature of self. And that's where these teachings about emptiness come in. Expressed, you know, in brief in the Heart Sutra. We mentioned this yesterday. So as we've been saying, also, if we take this packaging of Buddha's teachings, this Tibetan packaging, the very first stages of practice, you've got to control your body and speech first. You can't, if you can't control your body and speech, if you've got no decent ethics, if you run around shouting on everybody whatever you feel and jumping on every girl you feel like, how in the name of heaven on earth can you begin to even notice your mind? Not possible. How can you meditate? It's ridiculous. It's a joke. So ethics and discipline is like the very first level of practice, the foundation. Then on the basis of this, you begin to become aware of this amazing being we are, this marvelous potential, you know. So this technique invented by these Indians, as we know, is a central technique in Buddhism, single-pointed concentration. As Lama Yeshe told us, you know, if we look at it into some of the consequences of it, it's absolutely astonishing, so amazing, the consequences. Just speaking in a very simple psychological way. This, in other words, pointing to the extraordinary potential the Buddha says we have. Don't think of it as religious. Don't think of it as like a gift from somebody. It's really important, as we've been talking all week, to see it as a down-to-earth thing. Then it's very encouraging and very humbling, you know. And it's not what we think. To say that we've got Buddha nature, that it's the natural potential, it sounds so cosmic to us. But when we understand it logically and psychologically in very down-to-earth words, it gives us courage, you know. So one way of presenting this, we can hear this. I mean, I've heard it in some of the Tibetan traditions, and I've heard it about some of the Zen teachings. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I'll say it, what I've heard, is that sometimes we can almost, there's a way of saying that we're already a Buddha. Do you guys talk like that? We loopers would debate with you. My analogy is this. That's like saying an oak tree is already, an acorn's already an oak tree. Well, try getting shade from an acorn. You'll be disappointed. But my sense is, my feeling is, it's very powerful to say that, because the way ego is at the moment, we think we're the biggest creep on earth. To think that we've got potential to even change our mind is like too much for us to believe. We are so entrenched, and this is the irony of ego for the Buddha, because of all our unhappy ego grasping and attachment and anger, and it preoccupies us. So we are completely, in a way, addicted to the misery, and we really believe that's who we are. That's our terrible tragedy. So to hear that we're already a Buddha is kind of exciting. It kind of gives us courage, you know. It is another way of just putting it. It's already there. In other words, it's already there. We just have to unpack it. We have to kind of make it evident, if you like. Even that, perhaps, you know. But it's encouraging to think that. Because it counteracts this instinct of the irony of ego is we're hopeless, you know, small, miserable. So let's look at it in terms of emptiness, because the ultimate Buddha nature, the way they describe the ultimate, our conventional Buddha nature is this marvelous potential, this reality. And you could argue here in the way we talk, the work you do to get you to, you know, to accomplish it. We're speaking in a very traditional way, conventional way, using the concept of seeds and fruits, which is kind of organic and incremental. But they say the ultimate Buddha nature, that's the emptiness of our mind. And of course, because we don't quite understand emptiness, that gets us very confused, you know. So just kind of look at that again. We talked about it yesterday, wasn't it, or the day before? I can't remember. Emptiness. So why is it our ultimate? Why they call it ultimate Buddha nature? Because, you know, we were talking from Lama Yeshe's book on Mahamudra, this approach is a very direct approach, not intellectual, you know. as Lama says, Mahamudra is beyond intellect, beyond theory, beyond philosophy. You go directly to taste the nature of your own mind, which is a very powerful method. So as Lama says, this word Mahamudra, which has been cultivated for several centuries in Tibet, I think, I'm not sure. Maybe back from India, I'm not sure. Not sure. But this particular technique that, as Lama said, was taught very secretly to the most advanced yogis, the ones who were ready for it. It was mainly an oral tradition. And then eventually it was by the 17th century Panchen Lama, he wrote the text down, very short text, and Lama's commentary. He gave this in Australia years ago, the commentary on this text. So as we discussed, it's presenting the two modes of meditation. First, concentration technique, this genius thing invented by the Indians, which the Buddhists still use. And then the second one is where we develop insight into the empty nature, the emptiness of our mind, the emptiness of our mind. So the way they say, Lama says, Mahamudra, great seal is the translation, great seal. So in the sense that, that emptiness is the nature of whatever exists, this absence of inherent intrinsic existence is what defines, what seals everything as existing. In fact, the way to put this, you know, because we also know the flip side of emptiness is dependent arising, interdependence. And that helps us ground emptiness, not space out on it. But things are empty of intrinsic nature because they're dependent arising. Then this is what seals everything as existing. This is the nature of everything. And so, in fact, you could even say everything exists because they're empty of intrinsic existence. So, of course, we don't get this because the Buddha's suggesting that this the primordial grasping at the exact opposite, which we don't even articulate because it's so primordial. We can't even recognize it when we hear it. I mean, we hear Buddha tells us that everything is interdependent, which proves everything is empty, and we go, huh? I mean, who's heard that before? Who ever thought they thought things were not interdependent? We've never thought of it. Therefore, who's ever heard of things not being empty? We've never thought of it. So we have to see what Buddha means by this, you know. At least we can begin to get a taste for it. So the very fact that things have no intrinsic nature is why they can exist. The implication being that the way we cling to the I as existing now, and we don't realize we're doing this, but the way Buddha articulates it is, having the opposite of this view, the opposite of interdependence, we're like frozen in space, set in stone, concrete, ground to a halt. This is me, stuck, concrete, solid, and therefore rooted in fear and panic and drama, you know. And it's the exact opposite of how things exist. This is what Buddha's saying. We think things are like that. That's why we have so much pain and suffering and bump into everybody and have fights and arguments. Because we're so solid and concrete, you know. And then, of course, as Lama says in here, when we've realized emptiness, we have conquered the dualism of you, me and you. Because we have ego grasping, this colloquial term the Lama's used to refer to the primordial mistake in the mind that clings to the concrete me, because of that, that creates other. The grasping at me implies other. And that's this terrible dichotomy that the Buddha actually says we have invented, we have created it. And it isn't how things are. I mean, earlier today we were talking about compassion, you know, the compassion wing. We were going to some of the techniques of how to cultivate, especially using logic to smash ego's ridiculous misconceptions, you know. So compassion is one approach, a powerful way, isn't it, to break down, and that's really what we're doing on the compassion wing. We're breaking down the barriers that we have constructed between self and other. But emptiness, so they talk about, wisdom and compassion. So each has its own function. The compassion wing is reaching out to others, connecting with others, expanding ourselves to encompass others. And we've all got that. Just look at some of the virtuous qualities. Love, compassion, empathy, connectedness, kindness, generosity. That implies other. Then you look at self-centeredness and panic and fear and anger and distress and attachment and anxiety and depression. It implies separate me. We can see that, you know. And all Buddha's saying is that's not reality. So we're living in la-la land. And he says we've been living in this a long time. And because it's so primordial and so instinctive, we can't even articulate it. It's just, we just assume it's how things are. So that's why, you know, finally, as Lama says in here, Mahamudra, you know, a direct technique to go straight to the nature of your mind. It's beyond philosophy, beyond words, beyond compassion, beyond wisdom. That sounds very tasty, and it's necessary. We've got to do that. But at the same time, it seems to me, if we're really open, and here we are talking intellectual words, and it is only ever intellect until you've experienced it, but it seems to me if we're really open to the teachings and we really want to discover our true nature, want to become who we really are, then even hearing the words can be powerful. It can give us a taste, you know. So concepts aren't totally useless. If we leave it at the conceptual level, that's a disaster. It's like, as Lama says, it's like thinking a pizza packet is a pizza. You'd be disappointed. Or like thinking the recipe is the cake. You'd be nuts if you think that. So it's, even though it's still intellectual, still conceptual, we can get a taste, you know. That's helpful. Finally, then, of course, in meditation. And then eventually, every second of the day. So like we talked a bit about the word emptiness, didn't we, to try and get our head around it because we can really misconceive it. We can really fantasize it, really think it's nihilism. I mean, I know Tsongkhapa, our lineage lama, the 14th century lineage lama, says one of the greatest, you know, the biggest mistake is to fall into the abyss of the great mistake, to misrepresent emptiness as nothingness. This, you know, this can be really amazing. Very naturally we can think that. That's why if we see it in the framework of dependent arising, they're like the flip side of the coin, you know. One way is a conventional kind of affirming way of presenting something, and the other is a kind of a negating, abstract way of presenting something. But they each refer to the other. So seeing these two aspects of the same thing is very beneficial for our minds, you know. Dependent arising, as Lama Yeshe says, is the king of logics to prove emptiness. And it's easy to understand. To say that we're interdependent, to say that we depend upon this and that, that makes sense. We get that, at least intellectually. But like we talked the Heart Sutra, didn't we? And we looked at, you know, from reading a commentary by the Dalai Lama, it's really clear when the Buddha says form is empty. We discussed this. Form is emptiness. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Form is nothing other than emptiness. Emptiness is nothing other than form. This, as His Holiness said, that's a way to really make sure you don't kind of fly off into the abyss of the great mistake and think it means nihilism. As he said very simply, and you can use a form or anything you want, anything that exists, self, I, or cup. Cup is empty. Spell it out. Cup is empty of inherent existence. Cup is empty. Emptiness of inherent existence of the cup is cup. So in other words, emptiness, this is even a simple way of putting it, the emptiness, the absence of a certain way of existing is actually the characteristic of everything that exists. The absence of a certain way of existing, which Buddha says we cling to, which doesn't exist, is the characteristic of that which exists. So therefore you can never have emptiness without something. As Lama Yeshe says, Lama Zopa says, when you realize emptiness of the self, the I, the iPad, whatever, it's as if it doesn't exist. But dependent arising, conventional reality, it does exist. But what exists is so subtle, it's as if it's an illusion. It's as if it doesn't exist. And this is not just like clever yogi talk. This is very apparently very real. Because right now the Buddha talks about the two extreme views. Whenever we hear empty, we fly off and become nihilistic. Oh, well, nothing matters. Everything's empty anyway. Totally mistaken. And then we hear that something does exist as a dependent arising, and then we all go, oh, thank God, there is something after all. Grasp. The Buddha's saying we live between these two extreme views, and we go up and down like yo-yos between them, you know. They're neither true. So we've got to have this more kind of nuanced way of understanding these two so that it helps us then taste the reality, you know, of the no intrinsic nature, therefore dependent arising. This is how they talk, you know. So, of course, we can't get this first time. We've got to think of it, trying to hear the words, listen to them, especially if we're listening to the teachings, especially if we listen to somebody who's a valid practitioner, like, say, the valid teachers. who are knowledge holders. There's a nice word in Tibetan, knowledge holder. A person who's got the experience of it. Then the words are very powerful for us. We can get a taste. But as we've talked, you know, when we're looking at the first stages of practice, the very first stage of practice is control your body and speech. Control your behavior. Don't harm others. Have good ethics. Not just because you're going to be a good girl and get rewarded, but because Buddha's point is that that produces the person you become. You're the beneficiary of that. Don't think you're not. We should be delighted by that. We all know we want to be happy. So right at this ground level, create the causes to be happy. Control your body, control your speech. Then you can get to the next level and start to really work on your mind. And all this prepares us for the compassion wing and then prepares us to understand our Buddha nature, you know, to begin to be able to experience it. But let's again, we'll go on from where we were before. We'll talk more about the compassion wing. So the compassion is a way of breaking down barrier between self and other, and that makes you full of love and compassion, but you can't, that's not enough on its own. As His Holiness says, compassion is not enough. You've got to have wisdom. But wisdom on its own is not enough either. You've got to have the two wings of the bird. Wisdom is this, the clarity we get when we've realized our true nature, which is pretty sublime. And that combined with bodhicitta, that's the powerful thing. And each helps the other. Every time you chip away, every time you get a taste of your own true nature, your Buddha nature, that helps you come closer to others. And every time you reach out to others, that helps you get to see your Buddha nature. They kind of help each other, these two wings, you know. They're utterly integrated. You can't have one without, you could have one without the other, but it's not enough. We need both. Bird needs two wings. But the other one that's really evident, isn't it? And we can see this if we're working in prisons, working in difficult situations, in our job, let's say, helping people, working as a nurse in the, you know, in a really difficult situation. We can see we get drained and exhausted and dragged down. So it's really important to really understand what is it that's causing that, why we get stressed out, why we get exhausted, why seeing lots of suffering drags us down. That's because if we do the analysis of Buddha's view, the analysis of the neuroses in our mind, the stuff that breaks our hearts and hurts us and makes us full of pain and therefore causes us to harm others. This is practical. Look at the world. Behavior, you know. Anger, fear, panic, depression, anxiety, attachment. When we have these, when they're prevalent in our lives, we can look at the suffering it causes. Look at the world, you know. So then you might have some compassion. If you're a person who's like a parent, let's say, and you've got a really difficult relationship and you're really stressed and you don't know your own mind at all, you have no sense of who you are, you've got low self-esteem, you're miserable, you've got an unhappy husband. I mean, look at the world. You can have compassion for your child, but it'll be very limited. You're stressed, you're freaked out yourself, and then you've got another little being who needs you and they need your compassion. You're so limited in your capacity to give them anything because you can't even help yourself. That's why the wisdom wing's got to come first. So the more we work on our own being, less neurosis, less fears, less attachment, less jealousy, more clarity, more contentment, more capacity to see others and help them. This is why the wisdom wing is crucial as a start, as groundwork to enable us to help others. So in other words, attachment, this ordinary kind of this word, this huge emotional hunger we have to get what I want, to get our needs fulfilled. It's totally natural. The world has it. The Buddha's analysis of it in the neurotic sense, it's what drags us down. It's utterly miserable and it's a bottomless pit. We'll never get it. Not by using attachment. We won't get happiness. We'll just get more misery. So we've got masses of attachment. This completely pollutes our love and kindness. And then we have anger. When attachment doesn't get what it wants, that completely destroys your compassion. So you really, and then we don't have any stability. Then we start to reach out to others. We have a job where we help others. We'll come home completely exhausted because it gives us stress and anxiety. And we don't get stress and anxiety from compassion. The more compassion and these powerful virtues, as we call them, you know, when they are prevailing, when we really develop those, we are powerful and strong, and our compassion is rooted in wisdom. It's kind of got iron. It won't be sentimental compassion. Right now, we've got very sentimental compassion. We feel sorry for people. Well, that's driven by attachment. We have less attachment, less anger, less fears, more internal contentment in who we are, more powerful is our compassion. Because not only do we connect with others, but we can see others. Because we're not blinded by our own nonsense. And then when you see examples on the planet of people who are really benefiting others in a major way. That's why I think, you know, Dalai Lama, even if not a Buddhist, people can see he's a happy fellow. 60 years of misery. Look at his country, you know, destroyed, slaughtered. Still every day Tibetans coming over the mountains, you know, into Dharamsala, escaping. But look at him. He's like their father. He's like everybody. And anyone with half a brain can see he's not depressed. He's not stressed by it. It's very. So we should ask the question, not to say, oh, that's the Dalai Lama. Ask the question why we wonder he's not out of his brain. Well, he's the proof of the pudding, isn't he? As we say in English. Do you say that? Proof of the pudding? Siliana? Proof of the pudding? You can't. The proof of the pudding is in the taste. That's the point. It's the genuine article when you taste it. Well, the Dalai Lama's, you know, like the genuine article. You can see how he behaves. He might hear all his words, but he puts his, another one, he puts his money where his mouth is. Do you have that one in Italian? No? Okay, well, say it. He puts his money where his mouth is. I mean, he acts what he says. He acts what he says. That's very encouraging in the world, isn't it? To have someone who acts what they say. And it's evident, 60 years, think about it, people. Don't put him up on a pedestal because he's a Buddhist monk. He's done the work, you know. It has to be. There's the evidence. He cracks jokes about the Chinese. He cracks jokes about his enemies, you know. He's not stressed by them. And we should say, why not? Well, because he's done the job. He's got rid of the rubbish and he's full of the goodness. Speaking simply, he's achieved his own Buddha potential. He's become who he is. There's the proof of it. Fine, funny, wise, compassionate, intelligent. He's very powerful too. Just because he's, you know, kind and nice doesn't mean he's all soft and weak. I think that's where we need teachers. They're a living example showing you how you can be. That's pretty clear, isn't it? Just to even play music, it's encouraging to have a musician teacher. Otherwise, it's just on the radio, you know. You need a real person in front of you, a knowledge holder who shows you what it's like to be. That's very powerful, very encouraging, I think. And, of course, that's why the Buddha say, check up. Don't be all sentimental because someone's charismatic and you get all excited and then they'll want to jump on you and you get upset and you'll sue them. Did you get all that? I mean, look, we're so stupid when it comes to spiritual. Oh, wow, they're so charismatic, they must be a Buddha. Then you hear them having all the girlfriends and jumping on people and taking someone else's partner. So check up before you have a teacher, all right? It's very important. Do your research, you know. So having the example, I think, is so powerful. This is the one. So let's go back to this compassion wing. We're discussing some of the techniques that we can do in our meditations. It's kind of, it really is like logic arguing with ego's misconceptions, which is very kind of interesting. Let's look at this equanimity one again, like we talked before. So as we've talked the last few days at the earlier stages of practice, well, we really learn to understand Buddha's model of the mind, this very distinct presentation of the way the mind functions, the mental consciousness. And as we said, he talks about the three poisons, the three toxic emotions. Actually, they say that Buddha has identified 84,000 distinctive problems. But he, luckily, thank you, narrows them down to three. What a relief. The three toxic emotions. We talked about this a lot before. And the first stages of practice, where we're learning to control our body, speech, and mind for our benefit, the wisdom wing, we talked about it mainly in terms of the sense objects, you know, harnessing our crazy energy at the sensory level. Discipline, ethics, so we can then really taste the nature of our mind. Now here, on the Bodhisattva wing, we continue to practice, we continue to work on our mind, but here the emphasis is on, as I said before, breaking down the barriers that ego has constructed between self and other. So there's all these different approaches, you know, these different techniques that these Tibetans have been practicing, and they took from India. So the very first one, as I said, there's like the series of 11 little techniques that culminate in bodhicitta. So the first one, as we discussed before, and we'll do it more now, is the development of what they call equanimity. This is very specific. This is like the foundation upon which we then want to develop genuine love and compassion for all sentient beings. Now, these words are simple. It's not like emptiness. You don't have to squeeze your brain to say them. But this is pretty profound. So right now, how are we? Right now, what's the obstacle to this? Why is it we can't have love and compassion for every being automatically? Because we've got the three toxic emotions. So here, we define them, we look at them and how they're obstacles for us in terms of sentient beings. So we see it, it's pretty evident. We divide the world into three categories. We divide all beings into three categories. There's no fourth category. There are those we're attached to. We can call them friends. There are those we have aversion for. We can call them enemies, just to keep it simple. Then there are 99.999% whom we call strangers. And how do we feel about their friends? We have love and compassion for them. They're about the only ones. We have attachment, which defines them, you know, as gorgeous. And if they're attached to us and do what our attachment wants, we're prepared to love them. We're prepared to have compassion for them. That's cool. Like discussing Ron, my boyfriend, you know. I'm prepared to love Ron, want him to be happy. I'm prepared for him. I'm happy to have compassion for him, want him not to suffer, because he's attached to me and he does what my attachment wants. It's kind of brutal, but we can see it. So that's the friend. Now you have the enemy, you know, the ex-husband who threw you out for the younger version. And how do you see them? So this first one's through the lens of attachment, so they look divine. The second one is through the lenses of aversion, so they look revolting. So we do not have love and compassion for them. I'm very sorry. The moment they left me, my love and compassion turned off like a tap. And who's a stranger? Is a person who's neither harmed me nor helped me. And how do we feel about them? Couldn't care less. They could all drop dead. 99.99% of the universe. And if you look at it, because Buddha's view of the mind covers all sentient beings, all the worms and dogs and hell beings and spirits, the lot, not just humans. It's very interesting. Everybody has friends, enemies, and strangers. And this is so primordial and so natural. Of course we never question it. This is just the basis of the universe. Monkeys, dogs, ants, we all do it. Buddha questions it. He's kind of outrageous. He says it's a fantasy. We've made it up. In other words, and we should, like I said before, we should be embarrassed. It's totally self-centered. A friend, in the way we see now with attachment, is by definition a person who does what I want. So of course I'm prepared to want them to be happy and want them not to suffer. Easy. An enemy, by definition, is a person I don't love and don't have compassion for. Of course, if we start to practice, that's different. Look at the world. Why? Because that person dared to do what my attachment didn't want, isn't it? We should be embarrassed how self-centered we are. We define the universe in terms of how they treat me. We should be embarrassed. And what's a stranger? They've neither harmed nor helped. So I have anger and aversion and obsessed with the enemy. I'm attached and obsessed with the friend, and I don't even think of the strangers. They don't even enter my life because they haven't touched me. They've neither harmed nor helped. So I therefore see them as nothing. It's kind of intense. This is the universe. So to get to bodhicitta, we've got to cut past all this. And we've got to see the illogic of it. It's pretty ingrained. Can't just have gooey feelings and think you've got bodhicitta. So we've got to use logic as a way of doing these practices. We can use logic every day in your daily life, not just in meditation, to smash through these misconceptions, you know. So this equanimity, this first one, we're not even beginning to have love and compassion yet. That's like about the sixth one along. This is the foundation. And equanimity is very precise in this framework. It's the, when you've got it, this heartfelt recognition that friend, enemy, and stranger, and there is no fourth category on the planet, friend, enemy, and stranger are equal to each other from one point of view. They each wish to be happy. They each wish not to suffer. And we need to prove that to ourselves, deep in our bones, so it becomes experiential, you know. Easy to say it, but look how we are in ordinary life. Like I said before, maybe you're a grandmother and your divine grandchild is like the greatest grandchild in the universe. We all think our children and our grandchildren are the best possible. Of course we do. We have attachment for them. There she is. There's our little grandchild playing with a smelly kid next door. And you think she's horrible, the kid next door. She picks her nose and is rude. You can't bear the girl. So your little angel will just stop right there and say to yourself, well, that little smelly girl who picks her nose, she wants to be happy like my angel. This is a fact, but it's hard to see it because we don't feel it. And how do you prove this? Like I said, the example I used before is so simple it's embarrassing. Right now in our life, we have people who don't like us. So in other words, right now there are some people who see me as the enemy, aren't they? Us. I'm the enemy. Put yourself as the enemy here. Think of the person in front of you, like your ex-girlfriend or a person who's mean to you, who doesn't like you, who doesn't like you, who thinks you're awful. Well, they see enemy, don't they? They see horrible person. They don't want you to be happy. They can't even see you want to be happy. Of course they can't. They just see you their own projection. And then you've got another person in front of you who adores you. So for that person, your friend, and for this person, your enemy. We know this is true. And you know clearly in yourself you're neither of those. That's their fantasies. Their projections onto you through the lenses of their attachment and their aversion. And then, of course, the third one, you've got a stranger who doesn't know you and is so bored they can't even look at you because you don't exist for them. So you know in your heart you don't feel like a stranger, you don't feel like an enemy, and you don't feel like a friend. In other words, every minute whoever's looking at you, you only want to be happy and you only don't want to suffer. This is logic. So to switch that over, enemies, friends and strangers all want to be happy, all don't want to suffer. But to get to see the simple truth of it is we've got to get through layers of our own junk, you know. So especially if, let's say, when Ron leaves me for the younger version, and someone says, well, you know, Rabin, he wants to be happy just like you, just like you, you know, just like your whatever, whoever. And the first thing I'll say is, what do you mean he wants to be happy? He doesn't deserve to be happy. Well, this equanimity we're trying to cultivate has got zero to do with deserve, because the pedophile wants to be happy as well. Mr. Trump wants to be happy. Whoever you don't like wants to be happy. Some maniac politician, they want to be happy. And the meaning of this is very primordial. The Buddha's saying we all want happiness. We're driven by the yearning for happiness. We're driven by the yearning not to suffer. All of us. And all he's got, all Buddha's saying is, I found some methods, baby, how to get you to accomplish your true nature. So everyone's driven by this. And we're trying to get to that core. Not what their behavior is, not if they're saints or sinners, that's not relevant here. Which is, of course, gets in our way. This is already pretty profound. This first of these 11 techniques, you know. It kind of stabilizes us. And you can apply it throughout the day. I know I go on a lot of aeroplanes. You know, and there are lots of queues. Especially in America, you apparently sue somebody if they get in front of you. Even the security people won't give you permission because you've got to ask every single person behind you and forget it if there's 100 people. And they will never say yes, never. So you never jump into a line. And if you dared, say it's a friend who wants to sneak in with you. Oh, come on, it's okay, no one's going to see. Come on. But if it's a stranger, I mean, you'll sue them for wanting to get in the line with you because they're a stranger or they're an enemy. So we love to make our friends happy. We do not want to make our enemies happy, and we couldn't care about the rest. And so we've got to start questioning all this. You know, this is the whole point the Buddha's making. And how can we possibly have actual bodhicitta until we do this work, you know? I mean, when you read the qualities of a bodhisattva, I mean, for me, it's more cosmic than emptiness, I promise. Unbelievable when you hear about the qualities of bodhisattvas. Unbelievable. The marvelous accomplishments, you know. Talk about their true nature. But we have to aspire, you know, aim for it. Or identify with it, whichever words you like, whatever works for you, you know. So then remember we talked the other technique, there's a series of techniques, and we got to the third one. And the third little technique is we're gradually moving towards, you know, love, compassion, transform, exchanging self for others. This very marvelous approach to accomplishing bodhicitta, where you learn to cherish others more than self, which is pretty radical. So one of these little points is that, the third one, when we discussed it, and one of them there, one of the things we need to think about, is all beings are kind to us. Initially, that's absurd. And what does this mean? We began to discuss this. It's a powerful contemplation, a powerful thing to remember. But it means, if you think about it, since we were conceived, and this is very much based on dependent arising, since we were conceived, everything that has facilitated our life up until now has been the handiwork of countless sentient beings, as well as the death of countless sentient beings. Just the food we eat, even if you're a pure vegan, that wheat that you ate, which you think you're so holy to eat, was grown in a field where just before you started to plant it, a million little field mice were living happily, who had to get slaughtered so the wheat could be grown. So don't forget that sentient beings suffer, even if you don't eat their flesh. Buddha's saying the whole universe is pervaded by sentient beings. Our mouth, our body is like an entire ecosystem. It's a zoo. We know this. So just by existing, by walking, by breathing, we are slaughtering sentient beings. So when we know this, and then all the food we've had and the clothes we have and the glasses I wear, I mean, glasses, I could not exist without my spectacles. I promise. I can't see a thing. How kind sentient beings are. They're not, see, when we say kind, we think, oh, this kind person thinking about Rabina when they created the glasses. No, they never heard of Rabina. So kind here, the way to think, is the fact that these sentient beings have done that work and I somehow, therefore, am able to see. Therefore, I can keep my tootsies warm because I've got my nice socks. Put the heating. People put the heating in this house. People made the house. People made the carpet. People made the microphone. This had come out of a tree. Sentient beings made it. They might have been a pedophile. That's not the issue here. The fact that sentient beings work has facilitated, has enabled me to exist. That's logic. That's scientific logic, actually. But to realize that, I mean, look at the heart opening of that. Everything you see, you know, instead of just criticizing it or thinking it's lovely because you're attached or angry, you recognize that sentient beings made it, you know. We're happy to do that sometimes when it's third world workers and when Mr., you know, iPad all slave away in China, then we feel sorry for the third world workers. But everybody's done it. It doesn't whether they get salary or not. Everything is the handiwork of sentient beings. And that's how come we can survive. That's a pretty powerful concept. That's going to open the heart for sure. And that gives you the aspiration, I must repay their kindness. These are things that are evident, but we don't think of them. Whoever thinks of this? Because why? Because we're driven by attachment. When I go to the supermarket and I want my Vegemite, I don't want Marmite, it's revolting. You Italians don't know about Vegemite, do you? If you've been to Australia, you know. You know all about Vegemite. There's a bizarre thing that Australians adore on their toast. It's black, and the English invented it after the Second World War. It's a way for the poor old English to get some vitamin B. So it's extract from yeast, and it's like black, like gooey, disgusting stuff. Then Australians made their own version and called it Vegemite. And Australians are obsessed. I can't tell you. It's like, if you're in another country and someone's offering you some Vegemite, you get so excited. And you put it on your toast with butter. And it tastes disgusting for everybody else. Huh? he eats Marmite. How disgusting. There you go. So I'm joking. Because if I go to the supermarket, think about this. I want to see on the sign, where's the list on the aisle, where's the Vegemite, you know? I go to the Vegemite and I'm looking for what I want. And then you start to think this different way. Then you go to the Vegemite. Usually it's black stuff. It's in a jar that's printed yellow, you know. So then you start to think about it. Well, first of all, somebody made the Vegemite. So many people make the Vegemite. It's 100th anniversary recently, so they had all these advertisements about all the people who make Vegemite, all the people who play a little role in the Vegemite factory. They're real human beings, you know. People designed the words. People typeset the words. People created the font. This is real people. But if you're driven by attachment only, you just want to get what you want with the cheapest price. You're prepared to thank them, but not really, because we're driven by what I want. We're driven by attachment. We're driven by self-centeredness. We're driven by ego grasping. That's just normal world. So Buddha's saying we should see everything, see it from this different perspective, which is equally true. It's true that people made Vegemite. It's true that I wouldn't exist without my glasses. It's true that my feet will be cold if I don't have socks. These are ways of thinking that kind of stretch our heart, you know, connect to others. And, of course, it brings some humility and gratitude. That's the point. Instead of just this arrogance that we live. I want my Vegemite, please. This is real. It's really true. This is true. This is scientific. We just don't think about it. And the aim of this is to soften the heart, to get one little inch closer to connectedness with others and the wish to help them. How marvelous, you know. We have a short night. Ask me some questions and we can go to bed. Any questions? Okay, Max, come on.
Thank you so much for the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
You said earlier that mind is synonymous with consciousness.
That's the way we use it in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, yes.
And occasionally I find the word mind, the English definition is so, it just makes me feel uneasy because I associate it with being confused.
I know, well, I understand, Max. But this is interesting with language, isn't it? Like I often mention, you know, when I lived in England and Australia, we used to live in a flat. Now we live in apartments because we're all Americanized, okay? But we used to live in a flat. You know about that. You live in a flat, don't you? Just, you know the word flat.
Yeah.
So if that's the only, let's say it's the only definition you had. Do you understand? And you've never heard of geometry. And someone teaches you geometry and they say, well, you know what, Max, that's flat. And you go, huh? I've got to live there? No. You'll have enough intelligence to know it's the same word, same spelling, same sound, different definition. So you've got to get used to it. If you want to understand Buddha, you've got to know his definition. I mean, you've got no choice. Do you understand? And we're grown-ups. We can do that.
Well, couldn't just use consciousness?
Sweetheart, don't be stubborn, Will. You're a big boy. You can change your mind. Come on. Give me a break. Don't be ridiculous. I don't like the word mind. Come on, Will. You're a big boy. You can change your definition and get used to how Buddha talks. Can't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Enough then. Next question. Next question. Anybody like me to be rude to you? No questions? Come on, a little bit more. Questions. Anything. I said a whole bunch of things in that 1 hour. Come on. Go. Go, honey.
Since one definitions,
yeah.
You didn't speak about it particularly this hour, but when you use the term energy...
I've only used it a couple of times. But tell me, go on, say.
So, yeah, my question is, what do you mean by that?
Well, I only used it one time, I think, when I said that in, as Lama Zopa said in one particular, the Kala Chakra Tantra, he said in this relation to this Vajrayana model of the subtle physical energies in Tantra, how Rinpoche said how there's this intimate relationship between internal and external energies. So energies there is a general term for things that exist. So then he pointed it out, internal is mind and external is the physical. But I don't think I ever use it really. Sometimes I might use it casually. Do you remember saying a particular thing you can quote? Anger energy. Well, that's just a very loose use of the word, I'd say. I mean, we can talk about energy. Oh, she's got lots of energy, we'll say. But kind of energetic. I mean, energy is it's a very general word. I don't think Buddhism probably doesn't have a definition for it. Doesn't even use it. I'm just using it casually. Okay. Someone else? You don't have to have questions. I'm not forcing you. We can go to bed then. Okay. So, gone. 1 hour, like a dream, like a flash of lightning, wasn't it? I just remember sitting here and suddenly it's an hour later. So we think a whole hour, as many moments as there have been, is as many thoughts we've had, and as many thoughts we've had is as many seeds we've planted. How marvellous. Let's nourish those seeds. See it as this kind of growing of me and the growing of ourselves, you know? How marvellous. So if we're going to be coming back tomorrow, we'll do our little homework, which means... go into like retreat mode if you can, if you'd like to tonight, not talk, if you'd like, it's up to you. Retreat mode. Then when you hit the pillow, you make this strong aspiration that if you wake up in the morning, of course we all think we will because we grasp at ourselves as permanent. If you wake up in the morning, as soon as you come back to consciousness, notice you're still alive and think how amazing. You know, I'm not dead yet, so I'm going to make the most of this precious life. Listen, come to breakfast, come to meditation, come to breakfast, come to the class, listen to the teachings, take some tools from it, and this continue on this work in progress, you know, becoming who we really are for our sake and the sake of others, thinking like that. Chang chob sem chogrin poche. This prayer is just saying, may bodhicitta that hasn't grown, may it grow, and that has developed, may it increase in the minds of all beings. Chang chob sem chogrin poche, ma ke panam ke gyuchig, ke pa nyampa me pa yang, gong ne gong du pelva shok. That'll do. Thanks, everybody.